This show is brought to you by 13 Turns, a new horror anthology by Kevin Carr. 13 jolting tales of terror, murder, and the macabre. Only $2.99 in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Scotch potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. This week's new movies, we've got Tomorrowland, Poltergeist, Slow West, Good Kill, Tangerines, and of course, lest we not forget, Human Centipede 3, Final Sequence. We are also going to have the news, the trailer park, box office predictions, and of course, a world-famous DVD roundup. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to reach out to me on Twitter, I am at twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
In Superman vs. Batman, apparently, the rumor is that Lex Luthor, played by Jesse Eisenberg, is going to be using his war suit in the film, and I'm assuming if he's going to be using a war suit, he's actually going to be doing battle with somebody. Which, to me, is the best piece of news I've heard coming from the Superman vs. Batman camp, and kind of the DC camp in general, for a long time. Mainly because I come from the age, talking the 70s and early 80s, when Lex Luthor used his science, his evil genius science, to become a foe, a formidable foe, to actually take on Superman hand-to-hand, as opposed to when they just revamped him and made him just a stupid businessman in the 80s. I always thought that was annoying. Because he's not a businessman. He's a scientist. He's a genius scientist. He's the evil scientist. So I loved seeing this, and that maybe it's not just going to be, oh, LexCorp, this and that. And he's the most stereotypically dullard bad guy from the 80s and 90s, and now they're actually putting him into the war suit, which would be good. But of course, then that is all squashed when you realize that the other rumor this week that came out is that Doomsday will be appearing in this movie. If it's Doomsday, it's Doomsday versus Superman. If you know anything about the comics, there is no Batman versus Superman if Doomsday's in the picture. So, again, another DC character is going to be even more crowded, so that balanced out the good rumor. The next piece is, and this is just a note, I guess, I don't watch Game of Thrones. But apparently last week, the episode ended with a graphic on-screen rape of one of the characters. And kind of people went crazy, up in arms about it. And they're like, oh, they shouldn't have done that. And I mean, and people have taken issue with it. And there have been blog posts and think pieces all over the place. And I don't get why. Now, maybe this hasn't happened before in Game of Thrones. But Game of Thrones has never been considered a squeaky clean show. The movie is about lots of sex and lots of violence. And the showrunners and the original author kind of take glee in ripping people's hearts out when they kill characters that they like or do awful things to people. So why is this suddenly the taboo subject? I mean, it's not like it happened on New Girl. It's not like Winston came home on New Girl. It wouldn't be Nick because Nick's too lazy. And it wouldn't have been Coach because Coach has moved off with his girlfriend. And it wouldn't be Schmidt because Schmidt's in a committed relationship. Winston's the odd man out. He's the one who has a cat as his best friend. That guy's unstable. So it's not like that showed up in a New Girl episode. I can see people getting enraged and upset about that. Why would you get enraged and upset about a violent act that happens in Game of Thrones? That's what the show's about. Violent acts that happen to people you like. Now, jumping into another bear trap involving gender politics in movies, Maggie Gyllenhaal said that she was told in the casting process that she was too old to be the love interest of a 55-year-old actor. Maggie Gyllenhaal's 37. And it caused this firestorm and people said, oh, sexist Hollywood, this is terrible. And I'm like, when has this never been the case with Hollywood? This is how Hollywood has operated literally since Hollywood started making movies. The men can get a little older and the women are washed up by the time they're 30. And in fact, nowadays you can actually have a career in your 40s. Back then it was, you know, you play the ingenue and then before you know it, you're the mom. This is nothing new. This is why I find it so fascinating. But even then, ageism or not, here's the sad, awful, inconvenient, and unpopular truth. In general, men age better than women. That does not make me a sexist to say that. Let's take two celebrities who are about the same age. You got Tom Cruise, who's 52. He's almost that 55-year-old person that Maggie Gyllenhaal's too old for. But Tom Cruise, I mean, he's 52, but the guy looks really pretty good. He does not look like he's 52, that's for sure. And then compare him to 51-year-old Helen Hunt, who a couple of years ago, where she played the sexual surrogate, when she looks awful. She has had way too much work done on her face. Her body's all saggy and weird. And she's just not attractive the way she was in the 80s. That's not me being mean to Helen Hunt. That's just me being realistic. She cannot play the young, attractive. And unfortunately, women tend to age in their 30s. Men tend to age in their 40s and 50s. And that's just the way biology works. If you want to get mad at anyone, get mad at God, because that's how we were made. And what's interesting, though, is I never heard Gyllenhaal complaining about this when she was cast opposite James Spader in Secretary back in the early 2000s. And that's the same age difference, because Spader is 55 now. So back when she was in her mid-20s, she apparently completely could pass off as the girlfriend of a guy in his early 40s. But here, this brings up a bigger issue. Is it really just about age in this particular instance? I mean, it is. Yeah, age is lethal to a lot of actresses. But could it be that Gyllenhaal herself at 37 is not every other actress at 37? I mean, look at Reese Witherspoon. She's 39. And I don't think anyone would roll their eyes at Reese Witherspoon being the love interest for pretty much anybody. Look at Jennifer Lopez. She did that movie, The Boy Next Door, and she's in her 40s. She still looks really good. Megan Gyllenhaal just didn't age well. Sandra Bullock is 50, and she still looks fantastic. Or look at Sofia Vergara, if we're talking about Reese Witherspoon. That woman's 42 years old, and she's kind of made a career out of being the young, hot wife. That's what she plays in Modern Family. So I don't know whether this is necessarily a microcosm of the... It's a bit of a microcosm of the entire sexism and ageism in Hollywood, but I think it's also directed at Maggie Gyllenhaal, who didn't age as well as some of these other actresses. And that's too bad, but you know what? Gosh, that's the way it is. I mean, we only hear about this from actresses when they've reached their late 30s or their 40s. You know, when Patricia Arquette was giving her Academy Award speech, she wasn't complaining about this back when she was 25. And she was taking roles from older actresses then when she was younger. It's like the kids in their 20s suddenly realizing that teenagers are annoying and then bemoaning it and writing blog posts about how annoying teenagers can be. And you can say, hey, guess what? You were one of those annoying teenagers 5 to 10 years ago. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. The first one I want to talk about is Bat Kid Begins, probably the best thing that's coming out of the DC universe right now. And it's of course, we all know the story about the kid who has leukemia and he did a Make-A-Wish and they did this whole thing where they changed San Francisco into a Batman scenario and he went around and saved the day. This was a fascinating, just heartfelt story. They did a documentary on it and they're coming out on June 26th.
We waited until the end of treatment to make his wish.
That I want to be the real Batman was his exact wish.
Because he's my favorite superhero.
How are you going to be the real Batman?
When we're going about doing a wish, it is whimsical and thinking about what would wow that child. It gives them a little bit of their childhood back that's been robbed. So we decided to turn San Francisco into Gotham City. One of our volunteers put into Facebook and Twitter and like wildfire, just like it exploded.
I challenge anyone to watch this entire trailer if you're a parent and not find yourself moved to tears. I mean, this is a powerful story. And it's sad and it's heartbreaking, but it's also very inspiring. This is probably going to be one of the best things on Warner Brothers slate in the entire year 2015. So, I mean, it's going to push every button possible, but boy, it kind of earns it. So I'm looking forward to this one, but I'm going to bring the Kleenex. The next one I want to talk about is The Maze Runner, The Scorch Trials. This opens on September 18th.
Beyond this door lies the beginning of your new lives.
Hey, Thomas, we weren't the only maze.
What do you remember about Wicked?
I remember they sent me into the maze. I remember watching my friends die in front of me.
Don't you want to understand?
Understand what?
Why this all happened. I just need to know. Whose side are you on?
Now, I was not a huge fan of the first Maze Runner. I thought it was overwritten at times and shoehorned into a neat little box, and it didn't quite make sense, and then it doesn't end. It did well for a September release. I mean, it didn't do Hunger Games well, but it did well enough for a September release. I'm curious to see if this goes where Hunger Games got more complex and more interesting, or if it's going to become like Divergent, which just got dumber. Anyways, I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Tomorrowland and Slow West. Kevin Carr's new horror anthology, 13 Turns, brings you a series of stories inspired by H.P. Lovecraft, Stephen King, The Twilight Zone, and classic gothic horror. A man is trapped, forced to murder himself every day of his unnatural life. Necromancers resurrect two famous figures from history for sport. A beautiful day in an amusement park turns into a murder investigation after a mysterious death on a roller coaster. A researcher in an abandoned prison discovers a portal to another dimension. 13 Turns by Kevin Carr is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store, and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Kevin Carr with Fat Guys at the Movies coming at you. I am back, and we're going to dive right into the movie reviews. The first one is Tomorrowland, directed by Brad Bird, mostly known for working with Pixar. He did, of course, The Incredibles, which is fantastic. He also did Ratatouille, which is pretty good, too. Before he got to Disney, he did The Iron Giant, which is a beloved and wonderful little animated film. It did not do well. I think if The Iron Giant had come out today, it would have done better. It just was kind of a little bit of an unknown, and Cell Animation was on the decline at that point. But he, of course, redeemed himself as a director with the Pixar movies. And then, of course, he did Mission Impossible, Ghost Protocol. This is a live-action movie, and it stars George Clooney and Britt Robertson, who was, of course, in The Longest Ride. And the story is a teenage girl is approached by a mysterious child who invites her on an adventure to save the world.
What you saw was a place where the best and the brightest people in the world came together to actually change it. We've been looking for someone like you for a very long time.
Why? Did something happen over there? Something bad?
There's one way in. They know we're coming, so follow me.
All the people, why me?
He thinks you can fix the future.
I apologize for that somewhat vague description I threw in there. This is a unique movie. I mean, it uses a lot of tropes we've seen before, but it's a unique story. And it's frustrating because it's getting a lot of negative and mixed reviews. And reminds me of the response that a lot of people had towards Jupiter Ascending, which I don't think Jupiter Ascending is above reproach by any stretch of the imagination, but it certainly was unique. It was certainly unlike any other movie you saw. And it certainly was different than your standard superhero movie or sci-fi spectacular that was happening in the box office. Yet people resoundingly rejected it, especially critics. They felt glee in trouncing this movie. And I see people finding glee in trouncing Tomorrowland. Here's the thing with Tomorrowland. It's unique and it's different. And the part of the problem is to explain the story too much, you spoil too much of it. So I'm just going to say, leave it as that. It's this girl who finds this pin that when she touches it, she's transported to this other world. And it is fascinating. But the thing is, I think people, particularly critics, and especially sort of geek critics, they want everything to be made for them. You can't just make a movie for kids, and you can't make a family movie, because they kind of reject that stuff. And that's stupid, because just as much as you can have a movie for adults, and you can have something like Mad Max, which came out last week, that is completely for adults. It's not a kid's movie at all. It's violent. It's uncomfortable at times. It's not something for that you'd want to bring a six-year-old to go see. So what's wrong with having Tomorrowland being aimed at a younger audience? And that's absolutely what it is. Tomorrowland is aimed at probably an 8 to 10-year-old target range. And so it's Disney. That's what Disney does. Disney is an expert company at running a brand. And the brand in this case is kids with sort of that old school Disney style adventure, awe, and hope. And yeah, it's a little cheesy at times. And yeah, it lathers the comedy up a little bit too much. But it's a beautifully fun movie. And it feels like you've gone to Disneyland when you've seen this film, or Disney World. You feel like you've been on a Disney World ride, because it has that moment of wonder and a sense of awe. And it always bothers me, all the people who championed Mad Max Fury Road for being this big feminist manifesto are completely ignoring the feminist overtones in Tomorrowland. This is a movie that passes the Bechdel test with flying colors. It also has a female protagonist who essentially has a sidekick who's a guy and one of the biggest movie stars on the planet, even though he's not necessarily a huge draw money-wise. But it's a fun movie. It's a neat movie, and it's something I think you can take kids to, and it opens up their world, and it is geared towards a younger audience, and that's okay. It's a family film. And so what if it's not gritty and hard and dark? It doesn't have to be. There's darkness in the movie, trust me. But there's just some gorgeous things happening and a lot of fun. It took me a little bit of time to get into it. It probably took me about 20 minutes to really get sold on the movie. But once I was sold, I really liked it. Because it kept me guessing. It was something different. And we don't get that enough. And I like smart science fiction. I like unique science fiction. I'm not saying this is the smartest movie ever. But for something aimed at 8-year-olds and 10-year-olds, it certainly is. And it should open your mind and open your imagination. So I'm going to say that Tomorrowland totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. The next film I want to talk about is Slow West. A young Scottish man rides across the American West to find his true love, encountering a mysterious stranger who helps him along the way.
Keep heading west solo. You'll be dead by dawn.
I take care of myself.
Sure, kid. You need chaperoning. Let's drift.
Care not why I'm headed west.
No.
It was an accident. It was all my fault. My girl and her father fled from Scotland.
The bounty hunters.
What do they want?
Blood, money, and $2,000.
Last week, when I talked about Echoes of War, I bemoaned the state of the modern American Western. It used to be that Westerns were genre films, that Westerns were, kind of like Tomorrowland, aimed at a little bit more of a wider, less self-important audience. And somewhere in the 80s and 90s, that changed. I think part of it was you had the spaghetti Westerns coming through and the more contemplative Westerns and the iconoclastic Westerns that Clint Eastwood was involved in back in the late 60s and into the 70s. And then once Star Wars came out, the Western went into space, and real Westerns kind of just got lost in the shuffle. And it wasn't until Clint Eastwood came back with Unforgiven that people started to pay attention to Westerns again. And you had other things. You had stuff like Dances with Wolves, which is technically a Western, but it's not a traditional Western. It's an Indian movie. It's not cowboys and Indians. It's a Native American movie. Now, when they make Westerns, a lot of, they don't make Westerns for fun anymore. Westerns used to be always about fun. And yeah, you had some of them, like The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance back in the 60s or late 50s. And that one was very much a contemplative, turning the genre on its ear type thing. But a movie like Slow West or Echoes of War last week, these are movies that just get overly grim and overly drawn out. And this is Slow West. It should be called Slow Western. And that's not to say you can't have a slow burn in these movies, but if you play both trailers, they've got this rockin' soundtrack, and they've got this action, and they got quick cutting, and it looks really powerful. But then when you see the movie, it's a lot of people just kind of riding horses and having conversations with each other. And that's where I wasn't sold on Slow West. I mean, it's a well-made movie, and it looks very good, and I think everybody involved with it, the actors, Cody Smit-McGee and Michael Fassbender, they do a good job. But it falls prey to the typical modern Western, where it's more about atmosphere and it's less about really getting the story and wrestling it. It's a character study more than anything else. And nothing wrong with character studies. But this one just breathes so much and it's to the point that it hyperventilates. So, I mean, it's getting a lot of good reviews. I just personally didn't see why. So I'm going to have to say that Slow West kind of sucks.
It kind of sucks.
Oh, okay.
All right, that's it for the first segment. We're going to be talking about a couple horror movies in the next segment. We've got coming up on deck, Poltergeist and Human Centipede 3,
Final Sequence.
There is something in the woods, something worth killing for. In Kevin Carr's new thriller, Underbrush, four budding scientists work together to discover a secret hidden in the mysterious Kuykendall Woods. This dangerous chain of events is kicked off when a student disappears in the woods near a small college. Four graduate students are brought into an abandoned area of the forest for a secretive biological study, which is nothing more than a cover to look into the truth behind the disappearance. Underbrush by Kevin Carr is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's roll into the horror movie segment of this episode. I know it's odd. Usually you think horror movies come out in October, and that's the most appropriate time to release them. Actually, in Hollywood, they release horror movies all the time. The Conjuring, one of the biggest horror movies that is in the last couple of years, that came out in June. January is a dropping ground for horror movies, especially lower budget, smaller horror films, and August and September tend to be just as rich with horror as October is. In fact, October always has been reserved for the big horror movies like Saw, and then Paranormal Activity, and then everybody else gets out of its way. And even like any Friday the 13th movies, half of them come out on Friday the 13th anyways, and it might be April or September or January. But we've got a couple horror movies coming out this week. One of them's a famous remake, and that is Poltergeist. This remake of the 1982 thriller finds a family living in the suburbs experiencing a malevolent haunting.
Maddie was the first one to notice things.
Mom? How will you get here?
Who are you talking to?
When was the last time you had contact with her? Before she was taken?
I can't believe Maddie!
First things first. Your daughter is here, and she's alive.
The door to the world could close at any moment.
If that happens,
there's no getting her back.
I actually never saw Poltergeist in the theaters when I was a kid, because it was 1982, I was about 10 years old. And even though it was PG, it was a movie that my parents didn't, you know, they were cautious to take me to, because it has some pretty graphic stuff, and there's a scene where a guy rips his face off. I'm waiting for the people to complain that this remake is a PG-13 horror movie and how PG-13 is ruining the world, when Poltergeist, the first one, is at least partially responsible for the PG-13 rating, and in fact was rated PG when it came out. It was not an R-rated movie. And it was Poltergeist, and then later Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom and Gremlins, all attributed to Steven Spielberg. He's the one to thank for the PG-13 rating, by the way. Poltergeist was one of those movies that first started that national discussion of, is there something between PG and R that they can use? And that's what helped usher in the PG-13 rating. So I'm not bothered at all by the rating, because it's very appropriate for its original material. But the thing is, with the original 1982 film, Poltergeist was a unique movie in the sense that we hadn't had this big budget specialist effects spectacular for a haunted house movie. At that time, horror movies, they had haunted house movies. You know, they had, you know, The House on Haunted Hill back in the 50s. They had The Haunting in, well, I think 1960 was when that came out. You know, they had the Amityville Horror. So haunted house movies, there's nothing new with haunted house movies. It's just the amount of effects wizardry that went into Poltergeist is what kind of made it unique, the original, that is. And it was very much had the hand of Steven Spielberg involved, even though Tobe Hooper directed it. And so it also had that pre-Amblin, because it wasn't Amblin yet, but that pre-Amblin Entertainment, Steven Spielberg. This is when Spielberg was really cutting his teeth on his unique feel, the sort of suburban kids facing the fantastic, which is what identifies a lot of these Spielberg movies from the 80s, either that he directed or produced. When I started watching this remake, I remember thinking to myself, well, this is a wholly unremarkable shot-by-shot remake to a certain degree. And about the first half of it is very rote. It's what you'd expect. There's no surprises. And how can there be surprises when it's the movie that is a remake and trying so hard to be that remake? There's nothing at all that stands out. Any scene from this movie was better done in the previous film. Every jump scare moment has its roots in a better jump scare moment in the original film. A great example of how it's just not as effectively done There's a scene in the original movie where Jo Beth Williams is walking around the kitchen, and she goes to the sink and gets something. She walks past and you see all these chairs sitting around the kitchen table like any other suburban house. And then she walks off screen. The camera follows her. When she comes back, they're all balanced on themselves. And it's a really neat scene because you know the grips ran in there and moved the chairs while the camera was away. But it's a very powerful moment. They have a moment like that in this movie, but it's completely CGI'd. It's got a cut in it. It's not nearly as effective. The thing is, you could have made it effective because arguably the people who are seeing this movie that this is targeted at, you know, teenagers and college students, likely haven't seen the original because it's 30 years old. It was out before they were born. Now, that first half is, like I said, wholly unremarkable, but it's the second half that really falls apart because they bring in the character of the Ghost Hunter, which is played by Jared Harris, and he's essentially the Zelda Rubinstein character, but Zelda Rubinstein in the original movie was just, I mean, she was 4 foot tall, she was 4 foot wide, she had that little bun in her hair, and she talked, hey, Carolee Ann, go into the light. She was so iconic. And there's nothing iconic about this movie. I guess that's what it is. I mean, there's nothing in this movie that jumps out as saying people are going to remember this thing past August. It's going to come and go and be a blip. And it's not that the effects get too big, because goodness knows, the original, the effects were huge. But I guess in this movie, it just lost some of that power. It lost that oomph because there's nothing remarkable about it. It just looked like every other crappy, overly done CG remake movie, even though it has its roots in overdoing it. So, yeah, this was just disappointing. I would have liked to have seen a decent Poltergeist remake. I think they could have done it, but this one's not one. So the Poltergeist remake sucks.
It sucks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's move into the next piece. This is the one, oddly enough, I've gotten more questions about this movie than anything else at all playing this week. And that is Human Centipede 3 Final Sequence. An insane prison warden is talked into making a 500-person human centipede from the prisoners to keep them in line and literally on their knees.
Our prison has the highest violence rates, legal and medical costs, than any other institution in the U.S. correctional system. Things will have to change fast. I think I have a solution.
We've got to make a human centipede of our prisoners. They will literally be on their knees begging for your mercy. It's brilliant!
I have this weird love-hate relationship with the Human Centipede series simply because it's fascinating how captivating these movies are. Not the movies, but the subject matter, because it's such a horrible subject matter. I'm not going to explain to you what a human centipede is on the radio. If you really want to know and you don't know, go Google it. You'll figure it out. The first one came out several years ago when there was sort of this challenge for every independent horror filmmaker to make the most offensive and extreme and graphic horror movie. And Tom Six did Human Centipede. But the thing is, what's interesting about the original Human Centipede, as gross as the subject matter is, it's not all that graphic of a movie. It's actually somewhat tame. And then the second movie goes completely over the top and ridiculous and goes to a ludicrous level. And this movie, you know, it takes them so long to get to the human centipeding in this movie that by the time it happens, I'm kind of tired. The anticipation of waiting for them to make a human centipede, while they have a scene where it's happening and it's kind of gross, you're like, well, we've seen this done before. You just have more people. You're just putting more people on it doesn't necessarily make the human centipede any worse of an existence. It's got an interesting concept. But it is also gets weirdly introspective because Tom Six literally has a scene where he shows up in the movie and justifies his whole 100% medically accurate claim. I mean, it's like he's answering his critics in the movie, which is a little bit awkward and strange. And the cast is both brilliant and terrible at the same time. They bring back Dieter Laser, who was the guy from the first film, and he's fantastic in the first movie. And this movie, they just give him too much stuff. He just screams through the whole movie. And Lawrence Harvey from the second movie, who actually does a pretty decent job playing this weird prison warden's assistant, his character's kind of squandered in this. And then the most notable character after that is Brie Olsen, who's famous for being a porn star who lived with Charlie Sheen. If you've seen the other two Human Centipedes, you have to see this movie because you might as well complete the collection. I wouldn't say this is a good film. It's just a gross baby doo-doo movie. And other than that, I mean, it's got some graphic stuff in it, and it's unappealing at times, and it's not something you want to show the family at Christmas dinner. But I mean, if you go see Human Centipede 3, if you're grossed out, you deserve everything you get. You should know by now what these movies entail. So sort of for the discussion, I thought it was interesting to see, but it just doesn't, it would have been better if it was like 35 minutes. So I'm going to have to say Human Centipede 3 final sequence kind of sucks, but is also kind of worth seeing in a weird way.
It kind of sucks.
Oh, okay.
That's it for this segment. I got to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to review two more films, Good Kill and Tangerines, and I'm going to give the box office and the DVD roundup. Elizabeth Stokes' new romance novel, Five Nights in Vegas, is about meeting, getting married, and falling in love, in that order. Lexi Frost is a cocktail waitress in a Las Vegas casino. Nate Zimmerman is a marketing executive from back east. After a chance meeting on Nate's business trip, they wake up to discover they got married at an all-night wedding chapel. During their whirlwind attempt to undo their mistake, Lexi and Nate discover they might just be made for each other after all. Five Nights in Vegas by Elizabeth Stokes is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store, and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Kevin Carr coming at you with Fat Guys at the Movies. Final round of movie reviews before we hit the box office and the DVD roundup. The first film we're going to talk about, we're actually going to do a 1-2 punch. One of them's a foreign film, so I'm not going to play a trailer for that one. But it's sort of going to war in this segment. And the first one we're going to talk about is Good Kill. Ethan Hawke stars as a pilot who has a crisis of conscience as he flies lethal drone missions to the Middle East.
Ladies and gentlemen, the remotely piloted aircraft is not the future of war. It is the here and now.
Let's go to Afghanistan.
Fly and fry.
Make no mistake about it. This ain't PlayStation. We are killing people.
Light them up.
Yes. I am a pilot, and I'm not flying. I don't know what it is that I am doing, but it's not flying.
This is directed by Andrew Niccol, who has done some terrible movies like The Host, which I still like him as a director. It's just The Host was terrible. He also did In Time. I think it was called In Time, the one with Justin Timberlake and Amanda Seyfried. He also did movies like Gattaca, and he's done some cool stuff. This is him going a little more serious and doing a less of a sci-fi kind of role. And this is a movie contemplating the whole drone issue. Now, I'm not going to get into a big debate over drones. That's for another time, and that's for another show. But let's talk about this movie. It crams a lot of the issues that people have with drone strikes and what's going on behind the scenes and the decisions made. And it crams all those into this film. And while it makes those points, the problem with the movie is it has it's twofold. One, it muddles the problem because it's obvious that Niccol, when he was making this movie, wants to bring up the questionable nature of drone strikes and does it allow greater penetration and to make more decisions that are a little colder and innocent civilians. And it's talking about the double tap procedures and striking funerals and rescue efforts. But the problem is it dumbs those down. It makes them very Mickey Mouse and it makes them almost glaringly horrific. When I don't know what's going on in those booths, and I don't know about the decisions that are being made by the people making the shots to decide whether or not to make a drone strike, but they dumb it down to a point that it almost becomes a caricature. It makes a straw man argument out of the situation, and I think it takes, and maybe that's the point, is to say, well, this is at least what the people in the booths are seeing, and they're questioning it. And this is what's giving some of these drone pilots like PTSD and worrying and guilt issues. But it just doesn't do it very effectively. And the guy who's making the call on the other end of the phone, the guy from the CIA at one point, is so stupid. It's almost unbelievable. And there's no intelligence. And I'm not talking about like smarts intelligence, but actual intelligence from the intelligence community being displayed there. It almost makes it too easy of an argument, whereas I think it's a little more muddled than that. And then on top of it, it blurs the line because the character, Ethan Hawke's character in the movie, he's more upset because he's not flying a plane
and he's just piloting a drone from a booth in Nevada. And I guess I'm sure that pilots have that issue, but it's almost like he doesn't have a crisis of conscience because he's blowing up innocent civilians. He's having a crisis of conscience because he's doing it from a booth in Nevada and not doing it from a plane. That just muddles the issue. And then it throws in this whole bit with him, and he's got a drinking problem, and he's got problems with his wife, and it just doesn't hold together well. I mean, it's got good intentions in trying to bring this up, but it doesn't do it in a very effective way. But I'll tell you this, though, and I said this to a couple critics when I saw the movie, I wasn't disinterested. I wasn't checking my watch during the movie. It's a very well-made movie from a technical perspective and a pacing perspective. It just has some severe writing problems. And that's what really holds it back. And that's kind of what makes Good Kill kind of suck.
It kind of sucks.
Oh, okay.
The next film I want to talk about, no trailer for this one, is Tangerines. And the reason is it's Estonian. So it's in a foreign language. So you wouldn't know what it says anyways, unless you can speak the language. A lone man in Estonia finds himself caretaker of a Chechen and Georgian militant, demanding them to be civil as he nurses them back to health. Now, this one was nominated for an Academy Award for Best Foreign Language Film, so it's been a while since it's just been out there. This is a very well-done movie. There's nothing in this film that we haven't seen before. I mean, it's essentially the two enemies forced to be in a situation where they can't kill each other. We've seen this done many times before, where they have two sides and they hate each other, but they can find the humanity and they find a common ground and they eventually become a certain level of friendship. And I use that term very loosely, especially for this film, because it does take place in wartime, but it's very, very effectively done. It's a talk piece. It's not an action movie, although there's a little bit of gunplay in the film. But it also reveals, as beautiful as it is in the Caucasus Mountains, you're also dealing with some pretty ugly situations. But it also doesn't delve into the really horrible war crimes that you hear from the area, because that's not what the movie's about. It's about two opposing sides coming together and being able to live together, even in this very short amount of time. So it's very well acted. It's very effective, and it's not too long. And that's always tough. I mean, I gotta say this, because I mean, I may sound like a Luddite, but having to read subtitles of a very talky foreign film can be tiring, I'll admit. But yeah, it's a good movie. It's worth seeing. If you're one of those people who can handle foreign films and you like that sort of thing, especially if you like a character-driven piece, Tangerines rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
All right, you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. Let's talk box office. Was I correct? I said $39 million for Pitch Perfect 2. I was right in that Pitch Perfect 2 won, but I was way off in my prediction. Pitch Perfect 2 actually made $69 million. It made almost $70 million. It made more in its first weekend than the original did its entire domestic run. That's kind of cool, because this is a neat series, and I think it's cool that Elizabeth Banks is able to put herself on the map to a degree, and like a lot of the people involved, Rebel Wilson and Anna Kendrick, the only thing that disappoints me about it is it's not as good of a movie as the first one. And it always is a little bit of a letdown when a movie that's not as good as previous ones does better. But you know what? Hey, it was a remarkably well-positioned movie, and it did very well. Mad Max Fury Road came in with $45 million, came in second, and that's very good. A lot of people say it was disappointing, and I think that was because Warner Brothers, they spent like $200 million on this movie, so they wanted it to be the $100 million movie. It was never going to be that. It already was a niche property from a series that hadn't had a movie in 30 years, and it's an R-rated, non-story-driven movie, and it is a fringe idea. It's apocalyptic sci-fi does not necessarily always play well. In fact, it usually doesn't. So $45 million is fantastic for Mad Max. And then you got Avengers Age of Ultron, which made right around what I thought, $39 million, which is still doing well. I mean, Avengers Age of Ultron is well past $1 billion. It's even though it's not as big as the first one, it's still making tons and tons of cash. This week, and I'm going to stick with the $39 million. I'm going to say Tomorrowland's going to make $39 million. I think it's going to play better than most people think it will, especially grumpy old critics who aren't into the younger version of Disney Wonder. But that's because it's for families, and families are looking for something. There certainly wasn't a family movie that came out last week. I mean, Home is still in the top 10, but that came out, it came out 2 months ago. So people are looking for family movies, and it's Memorial Day weekend. A lot of people are going to be at the theaters. I think this is going to play well with families. $39 million for the 3-day probably around $50 million for the four-day weekend for Tomorrowland. That's my predictions. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr, and that sound means it's time to roll into the world-famous DVD Roundup. This week, the big one is the biggest movie domestically of 2014, American Sniper, Clint Eastwood's film about sniper Chris Kyle, is out on DVD and Blu-ray just in time for Memorial Day. And yeah, that's a pretty deliberate play to put it, you know, it's about the military. You're going to release it around Memorial Day. Now, in terms of Clint Eastwood also, I want to throw this out there. I missed this earlier, but I was sent the Clint Eastwood Universal Pictures 7 movie collection. It has westerns and thrillers in it. And there's 7 different movies. Some of his most well-respected movies are in there. They have 3 westerns, and that's Two Mules for Sister Sarah, Joe Kidd, and the brilliantly done High Plains Drifter. And then in the thriller section, you've got Coogan's Bluff, The Beguiled, Play Misty for Me, and The Iger Sanction. So you got 7 movies for Clint Eastwood. It's an expensive set, but it's on Blu-ray. And while there's not a lot of special features, it does have these movies in high def. And there's been such a push for Clint Eastwood with the Warner Brothers collection a couple years ago, about 5 years ago. And that's where he's done most of his films. But yeah, he's still done stuff for Universal. And this is a nice listing if you want to catch up on some Clint Eastwood movies. Other films that are out, you've got Leviathan, which is the Russian bid for the Academy Award this year. Strange Magic, which it's not getting a Blu-ray release. It's just getting squeaked out on DVD. It's that Lucasfilm animated movie that didn't do very well. It has some good voice cast, but it's not great. I think it might play better on video, though. There's also Glee Season 6 and the full series. And then Orange is the New Black Season 2, if you want to catch up on TV items. The stinger of the week is Hot Tub Time Machine 2, because, dear Lord, that was awful. And the first one was fun. This one is just, ugh, not funny and painful. Next week, I'm going to be talking about the disaster film San Andreas and the potentially disastrous Aloha. Until then, have a fat time at the movies.